with the Oral History Department at the University of Wisconsin. And it is January 9th, 2008. And with me today is Dr. Maymay King Chun. That's M-E-M-E-E. And the last name is Chun, C-H-U-N. And Maymay was in the Department of Pediatrics, and she has a very interesting story to tell us. So, Maymay, let's start with where you were born.
Okay, I was born in China, in the city of Shanghai, which has grown tremendously since I was born. And I was born at home and delivered by my uncle, who was an obstetrician trained in Germany. I'm not sure I remember anything before age four. My parents left for Europe for a meeting. My father was a diplomat. And so they went to Europe, Switzerland to be exact, for a meeting. Then he was told he was going to be sent to Holland, at which point he decided that I should join them. My oldest brother came with them. He was seven, and I guess more reasonable at that age. I was four, and my first memory of my childhood is that a cousin of mine brought me to Europe, and on the ship, I don't remember anything. It was an Italian boat, that's all I know. We got to somewhere in Italy, and my father has sent his chargé d'affaires, who was a Dutch person with a goatee and very dark eyebrows and dark hair. And I remember being terrified of him. He sat opposite to us in the train all the way to Holland. And I somehow, my memory is that he was weird. I must say that he turned out to be the nicest person I've ever met. But anyway, when I got to Holland after not seeing my parents for almost a year, I really didn't know them either. But things got along okay. An interesting sideline is that my mother was supposed to be in poor health. She had an irregular heartbeat, which now we know is benign. So she got a governess for me. And the governess insisted I should speak French. I only spoke Chinese. And I should not see my parents except at mealtime. So I spent my first few months screaming in a room which she locked me in. And my brother, who knew French, you know, was trying to help, but it didn't help. So finally she left. She couldn't stand me, I guess. And my mother got a governess from Switzerland, who was very gentle and, you know, helped me learn the language. I got to school. It was the Sacred Heart in Holland, so I learned French. And the first day there, I didn't know that much French, but my brother was down the hall, so he came back to interpret for me. But I stayed in that school until 1940. The diplomat service had, not the diplomat service, but the school had a special class for most of the diplomat children, because otherwise we would have learned Dutch. But my father decided Dutch would not serve me anywhere else, and so I learned French. The reason we left Holland was because Hitler moved in, and that was May 10th of 1940. The planes came overhead, and eventually after 2 days, Holland gave up. And we stayed there. The classes resumed. The Germans said, everybody go back to school and so on. But that summer, they told all the diplomats, you have to leave. You have two choices. You can either go to Germany, Berlin, or you can go to Geneva. And I guess my father was sensible enough to take us to Switzerland. I have to add something, is that my brothers went to a German school. And in the German school, of course, the Hitler Youth was quite active. They didn't try to change them, but they were in this environment. In Switzerland, my mother, who decided that education is the most important thing, sent my second brother and I to the public schools there. So we spent a semester there. The older brother was not sent anywhere because he was in high school and they didn't know where he fit. So he was tutored by my cousin, who was a college student at home. We did go up to Vilar, which is a mountain resort, and spent part of the winter up there because my parents decided we needed to get away from the blackouts, the sirens, and all that kind of stuff. And then my father was told he was to go to London. So we came off down the mountain and took a train through France and Spain to Portugal. Now you have to remember that Spain had just become, the Franco regime had started, and China did not recognize him. So it took us a long time to get visas to get through there. And of course, French countryside was under Vichy. We got to, apparently it's Barcelona, and we had to wait there for the next train. And I remember the food was terrible. You know, the bread was one little black thing. So the day we crossed over to Portugal, my brothers and I on the train ate nothing but white bread. In Portugal, we settled down into an apartment because we didn't know how soon we would get to England. My father flew there first. He had priority and got to London, stayed very close to the Royal Palace during the London Blitz. My mother decided that my brothers, because they were boys, needed to have no interruption in their education. So she asked some friends to take the two of them who were 14 and 16 to America and to be educated. I was taken to London because if I miss school, girls don't need to be educated. But while we were in Portugal, she sent all three of us to school again for whatever few months we were there. So education was important, but there was a trade there. And by that time, my father had found a house just outside of London, so we moved there. I knew no English, but I was sent to English school, of course. And the first day, somebody took my hand and led me around. They gave me an entrance exam where I signed my name, and that was it. I didn't understand a word what they were talking about. There were no special classes for foreigners. So they gave me a book to read, and it was A Tale of Two Cities. And with a dictionary, with my father's help, I loved the whole story. And that's how I learned English. Plus, my father had the London Times, and the editorial always had a very good articles written by, you know, an English writer about all kinds of subjects, not necessarily the war. So he made me read that every day. That's how I learned English, actually. Of course, the school taught me English. But they never really took me aside and taught me grammar. So my grammar is not the greatest still. And I stayed there for my high school years. And then I went home to Belgium, which is where my father was stationed at that time. And I signed up at the University of Brussels, but after 2 weeks the classes hadn't met yet. And in November I found out that my father was going to Cuba for a meeting. So I packed my trunk and said, "I'm going with you," with the intent of stopping in the United States to go to college. It was mid-November when we came on the Queen Mary, the first one. And on the ship, which was really rough, somehow our table survived, and I was talking with the president of Swarthmore College, just chatting with him. And he found out I wanted to go to college, so he said, "Come to Swarthmore." He knew nothing about me, except that, you know, I'd been educated in England. So I told my parents, and then my mother found out that there were boys there too. She says, "You're not going to Swarthmore." So I told the president, and he says, "Well, I'll introduce you to Catherine McBride, who was the president of Bryn Mawr." And I got accepted by Bryn Mawr. No records, no high school records, nothing. I went to Cuba with my father, then I went back to the United States in January of 1948. When I got to Weimar, I found there were two other foreign students. One had escaped from Hungary. She had walked out of Hungary to Austria. She had an aunt in New York, so you know she went to New York and she was sent to Weimar. Again, no records. And the other one was a girl from France who thought that college meant boys. And when she found out there weren't any, she left.
So your mother would have liked her.
But it was interesting that they would accept foreign students without any records, you know. And, you know, I went on to an MD and she went on to a master's degree at Harvard in chemistry.
Mm-hmm.
So I think the two of us...
I think you set a pretty good record.
Did all right. But that was their sort of, what do you call that, you know, their intent was to accept students from other countries.
Mm-hmm.
While I was there, there were six or seven other Chinese students. And some of them came through the high schools, but a lot of them came directly from China or Hong Kong. So I think they're willing to take the risk. At Weimar, it was a little strange because most of the American girls were very nice to me, but they didn't really invite you to their homes or anything. Well, the Chinese girls, we sort of formed a group, went and stayed together on vacations. We had no family. And when I went back for my 40th reunion, I said to one of my housemates, I said, you know, we never really got close to the American girls, except a couple. And she said, well, we were shy and we didn't know how to approach it. You know. And I was a little surprised by that, you know, because the school was so open. They had a lot of foreign students. You'd think that, you know, they would be able to at least communicate better with us. But anyway, I majored in biology. And I had a professor who said to me, you want to go to medical school? You should try it. The first person I talked to about medical school was my grandfather. This was when I was in high school. I wrote him a letter in Chinese, which I can't do anymore, but he wrote me back and says, go for it, girl. You know, here he was in his 80s or something, and he thought that was a great thing. My parents did not agree with him, but he was the first one who encouraged me. But my professor, Brimar, really was, you know, is the one who really not only encouraged me, told me what courses to take, helped me buy a microscope, and wrote a letter so that several places accepted me. The reason I went to Columbia is that they had a dormitory. So I thought, I don't have to cook for myself, I don't have to clean the room, you know. I mean, I'm going to have enough to do. So I accepted Columbia. And the interview there was very nice. Severinghaus, you probably never heard of him.
No,
he had been, I think he was in anatomy. He had been at the Peking Medical School for a few years teaching there. So he interviewed me and was very positive about the whole thing. You know. The first day of class was, we've accepted you 120 people, and 12 of them were women, and we've already spent $10,000 on you, so we're not going to flunk anybody unless you really try to flunk, which is different from other schools. If you listen to Ray in Georgetown, they said, look right, look left, they won't be there next semester. You know, a little frightening. So it was very positive, and the whole medical school was positive, except for a couple of professors, of course. You know. So when I graduated from there, I knew I wanted to go into pediatrics. I applied to Bellevue Hospital and for internship, and applied to Babies Hospital for a residency, and I got into both. So I had a tremendous experience at Bellevue Hospital. I don't know if you've heard of Bellevue.
Oh, indeed, I have.
It's the hospital where you never refuse a patient. It's the last of the city hospitals. And it was a big city hospital, and there were police all over the place, including locking doors and Well, but the experience was fantastic.
I can just imagine. We're going to talk about Babies Hospital here for
a minute. Babies Hospital was part of Columbia Presbyterian Medical Center. And I guess it started, I can't give you the history of it, but it started a long time ago. And now it's called Children's Hospital, I think, Columbia, and Cornell's name, I can't remember, Cornell University. They've joined up together, so that the name is Cornell's name and Columbia, PNS. The hospital has changed names, so you won't find Babies Hospital. It was at 168th Street, which is a little bit away from the campus, but that's where Presbyterian Hospital was, and the medical school is there too. The area at that time was not that bad. We would walk outside by ourselves, you know. It was okay. Apparently since that time it went downhill quite a lot. But it has improved again. All of New York has. I spent 9 years in New York, so I got to know it pretty well. First at Bellevue, which was a huge place. When we had a C-section, we had to run 2 blocks to get to the OB section. Very often, by the time we got there, the section was over. But otherwise, we were fairly together in one of the buildings. We had our own emergency rooms. And one time, I was on the emergency room, and I could see this child having seizures. You know, so I said to the nurse, actually, I went and picked up the child and started going in, and this father blocked the way, and she says, I'm next. And the police came and moved him. They took care of the seizure child first, you know. But the patients were fairly assertive, I think is the word. Another one wanted to sue us because we didn't give her penicillin. And 2 days later, she came with her child. 2 days later, she said, she got penicillin from another hospital, and he's still not better. So anyway, it was interesting. At Babies, it was a little bit different. We had a different clientele. They came from all over the city, actually. And our faculty staff was much bigger. At Bellevue, we only had so much faculty, so very often you and the resident did everything yourself. Emmett Holt was great. He was our chairman at Bellevue. And there were a couple of really good. Krugman was the infectious disease person, who was also very good. At Babies Hospital, it was Ruslan McIntosh. And he had an interesting of getting to know his residents. Every once a week, one of the residents would present chart review about a subject to him and the rest of the residents. So he got to know each one of us very well. He would always be there with us. It's interesting, I'm mentioning this because after I finished my residency, I applied to Baltimore, Hopkins, where Tausig was the cardiologist there. She only accepts 5 fellows from the United States and 5 from the foreign countries. And I got accepted, and he called me in. He said, you know, I don't think you'll be happy at Hopkins with Tausig. And I kind of looked at him and said, well, what should I do? He said, we'll have a fellowship for you here. So I stayed at Babies Hospital in oncology. I guess I was the first fellow in that. And I had a very good time, too, because the surgeon I worked with was a pediatric surgeon and a hematologist, and the radiologist, we all worked together as a team, which they had not done before. You know, so it was a very good experience for me. Mm-hmm. And this is where I met Ray. So if it wasn't for McIntosh, I wouldn't have been there.
That was wonderful.
So interesting. If I finished my 2 fellowships there, by which time I became a green card carrying foreign person. I don't know what you call somebody who's green carded.
Visitor.
Visitor, okay. Which meant I could leave the country. Before that, I couldn't, because I wouldn't be able to come back. Because I had thought I wanted to go to Canada for the cardiology, but I couldn't, you know. So anyway, side effect. Okay.
How does one become a fellow of the American Cancer Society? Does the Cancer Society fund the fellowship?
Yes. Yes, they fund the fellowship. They fund you just like a resident, which actually was fantastic as far as we were concerned, because at Bellevue we got $71 a month.
Was your mother still insisting that you live in a girl's dorm or something?
I think when I got to medical school, she gave up. And then after that, I think she was pretty proud of me when I graduated.
I'll bet she was.
And my father, you know, just told me, if you're going to go to med school, you have to be on your own, because he was retiring and he earned less than he could afford, you know. And so I did. I got a fellowship. No, I got a scholarship from Bryn Mawr. And you have to understand the political situation. At that point, Chiang Kai-shek had left China, went to Taiwan. And America had a certain amount of money that they were going to give to Chiang Kai-shek on the mainland, which they were not going to give to him in Taiwan. And so they offered it to students who were already in America, and you had to state your reason for getting this. And they would help you pay your tuition and some of the board. No books or anything like that. But so a lot of students applied who really didn't need money. And when I was in Bryn Mawr, my advisor there said, you really should not be, you know, applying for this. But when I got into medical school, she helped me apply for this, and I got it for 4 years. And I got Bryn Mawr scholarship for 4 years. And I worked. So we managed. Mm-hmm. By which time my father did retire. Mm-hmm. He came to live in the United States.
He did.
He came here because my brothers and I all were here.
Mm-hmm. And what happened? What did your brothers do?
My oldest brother actually went to Cornell for chemistry, but then when he graduated, he came back to Belgium and realized that he really wanted to work with international groups. And his father-in-law worked for the bank, the World Bank.
World Bank.
And so got him in as a clerk at first, and then he gradually went up to be a trainee of all the foreign people who worked at the World Bank. Or is it the other part, international? Well, that's all right. And he retired from that job. My other brother, whose life was even more interesting than mine, actually, he got left in China because my parents already had a boy and a girl, and my aunt had no children, and she really wanted to adopt him. So when I left China, he stayed behind. Then we went back in 1936. And at that point, Japan was moving fairly rapidly. And so my aunt said, take him, you know, he'll be safer in Europe. So he came to Europe, and he knew only Chinese. He was sent to the German school with my older brother, and he just couldn't handle it. His behavior was also, he had been spoiled rotten. So my parents sent him to a boarding school in Belgium. Okay, so he went from Chinese to German to French, where he studied for, I think, close to a year, and then he got diphtheria and was pretty sick. So they brought him home and put him back in the German school after he got better. And then when we went to Switzerland, he went back to French again. Okay, so he went back to French. And then when he got to America, he didn't know any word of English. So on the boat, he said to my oldest brother, what am I going to do when they talk to me? My oldest brother, just say okay to everything. And he did. He said okay to everything. He became an interior designer, which is an architect, which designs, you know, not furniture, but the outline of where the wall should be and that kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. And he was fairly successful. He had a very good mentor. I don't know her name except Maria, who hired him after he finished college, and then he went on his own after that. Did very well. But both he and his wife died of pancreatic cancer.
Oh my goodness.
We were 4 years apart. You know.
Mm.
So, but my older brother's doing pretty well as you can be at our age. Let's see, where were we?
Well, we were still in your cancer training.
Okay. The
National Cancer Institutes of Health. That's in Washington,
that's
isn't
NIH.
It?
No, I trained at Babies.
Oh, at Babies.
But I for see. Both, the fellowship was from those two places.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess in those days, they had a lot of fellowships for various specialties. So that was one that, for our hospital, was new. And to do that, we joined a study, a leukemia study. And so I was trained on how to do the study while I was at Babies Hospital.
Mm.
When Ray came back to Wisconsin, we got married, and the chairman here came and offered me a job on as an instructor in pediatrics. And the salary, which was more than I had gotten as a fellow or resident. So I thought, wow, this is great. So I came here and started the program here. We didn't have an oncology program here. And joined our group because I had been trained in the group, so you know we could join them too. And there was a lot of paperwork that you had followed patients and all that. But when I got here, I found out that they really were not prepared to do oncology because they didn't know how to stain a bone marrow slide, which is how you make a lot of your diagnoses. And so I had to train the technician how to do that. And we got into a very good team this year and I. So we were able to set that going. The following year, I had Michael, which is our oldest son.
All right, now, just wait a second, because this tape is going to run out on this side.
Okay.
Let's talk about that on the other side of the tape.
Okay.
But where were you with this green card business? Because you became a United States citizen.
In 62.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I got it in 55, I guess.
Mm-hmm. That was after you came here?
No. 55, I became an intern.
No, it says 61 up here in citizenship.
Yes. Well, it's 56. It takes 5 years.
It takes 5 years?
Yeah, and then I got it when I came here.
Mm-hmm.
You know. That was a funny story. You don't need to put it in there. But
well, I think we ought to have it in here. I just don't want the tape to run out.
When I applied for the green card and citizenship, the guy there was really kind of obnoxious. And he said to me, well, you know, it's going to take you 5 years, you know, once you become a doctor, they won't refuse it. But why don't you just go out and get pregnant, and then the baby will be a U.S. citizen, you will be too. Sexism. Anyway, I didn't follow his advice.
All right, good.
I met Ray Chun, actually, and I was Mamie King. That's why my middle initial. I met him at Columbia at Babies Hospital when I stayed for my fellowship. And he came out there for a one-year fellowship with Sidney Carter, who is the father of pediatric neurology. Fantastic man. He wrote to us until the day he died,
mm-hmm.
Can you imagine? So he came for that, and we both think that we met the first time in the elevator. But when we went back there, we couldn't agree which elevator. But anyway, and he was coming back to Wisconsin because he was working with Frank Foster here. He had come as his fellow, I guess, resident, whatever. And so I said, well, you know, I can't go without a job. And first place, I wasn't going to just go there because I was going to go and practice in Maryland. So he said, well, let's get married and I'll talk to Nate Smith. And he'll, you know, so Nate Smith came down, found out what I was trained in, says, oh, you know, you're welcomed. And that's how I got the job of instructor. So we came, and I started the program here, which was, I trained two fellows, one who went back to Geneva and did their work there, and the other one who stayed on the faculty here. In 1961, I had my first child, and I decided to cut down to half time. And at that point, somehow I found out that the fellow I had just trained was taken as an assistant professor. If you look at there, I've been clinical or instructor for years. And his salary was close to double mine. So I went up to Nate and said, "How come?" He said, "Well, you've got a husband to support you. And poor Gil doesn't, and he's got two children." And I agreed with the two children of Gil, and he needed the money, but, you know, I was working as much as anybody else. We rounded like 8 months on the wards because there were just a few of us, you know. So another year I worked, and then finally, there were two reasons I quit. One of them is personal. My child was getting to be a two-year-old. I was really showing the temperament of a two-year-old. And I decided I needed to be the one who disciplined him, not the babysitter, who actually was fantastic, but that's beside the point. And then after thinking about it, I thought, boy, this is not fair, you know, that I should not get the right amount just because I have a husband. And I suspect also it's because I'm a woman, but that's, he didn't say that at least. So I quit. And after a while, I really decided I was getting pretty bored at home. So I worked for the public health in Madison. I don't know if that's in here somewhere. I think so.
Mm-hmm. It is.
And also, we left to go to Europe when, you probably have that on Ray, but he got a exchange fellowship in Zurich, Switzerland. And so we went there. And coming back, that's when I started with the public health. And it turned out that not only did I have two children, but I had a third one, which was unplanned, but here he was. So I worked, you know, for them for a while. And the reason I quit working for the public health is that I was seeing like 10 patients at first, you know, in an hour, which is reasonable. But those patients got to know me, so they would come back with their earaches and everything whenever I was there. And I ended up with 20-some patients in 1 hour. So I talked to the person who runs the clinics, and I said, you know, I'm willing to increase my hours without increasing the pay because the patients really need it. And they said, oh, no, we can't do that. You can only see so many patients in 1 hour, and that's it. You know? So I said, well, I think I'm doing injustice to the patient, because they would wait to see me, and I don't have time to see them. So I quit. And I told the public health, you know.
Where was this clinic?
Oh, all over the place.
Oh, really?
Yeah. North side, downtown, mm-hmm. East side. And so the patients there, you know, knew I would be
sure.
there once a month.
Sure.
And so they would wait there once a month, which I thought was, you know, not so good. And by that time, I think we had a free clinic on the east side, too. So I thought, well, at least they'll go there instead. So I quit that. In the meantime, my daughter got sick, and so I was seeing Mark Hansen. Have you interviewed him?
No.
Oh, he's fascinating. He's not just pediatrics, he's family practice, so. We write him down as family practice. And his professional life is very interesting. But he was taking care of our daughter, and he said to me, you know, you should come back to work. And I explained that I've got three kids at home, and, you know. He said, well, come twice a week just to teach the medical students, 2 half days, you know. So that's how I got started, and that's why I was still a clinical instructor, because he said, you started at an instructor level, I can't raise you as a, you know. All along he's been my, not mentor, but my supporter. And every time I was doing something more, he would say to the faculty, he says, you really need to raise her level of in the, you know, in the scale. So he was the one who always helped me. But he said that, you know, you started so low that you can only increase so much. Okay. So I did that. I taught half a day, twice a week, three times a week, four times a week. Eventually it was half day, full, you know, the whole week. And at that point, one of Ray's new colleagues came. His wife also came, and she had a baby. So we split the job. She came in the morning and I came in the afternoon, I think. And we would both be there for our meetings. So we told them, you know, this is really a better way to have people, because if you only work half time, you're gone. But this way you have a whole person, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And they had two people at meetings. And so they agreed with that for, I think, a couple of years, and then they left town. I never really went back full-time until my last one was in high school. It went up to 80%, where I was taking calls like everybody else, working that many hours like everybody else, but I could leave when he had a soccer game or tennis, you know, that kind of stuff. And I didn't feel too guilty about it.
What did you have that was special that they wanted you to teach? Was it just general pediatrics?
Yes.
But now you had all this cancer training.
By that time, they had somebody else train, and then Paul Sundell came in. Plus, they never really gave me the credit for starting the program here. Paul Sundell never knew about it.
What was the program?
It's the oncology program.
The oncology
program. Where you have to have somebody certified to teach and have fellows. And you have to be in these studies. And of course, by the time I left, they had increased studies, not just for leukemia, but for the solid tumors, as we used to call them. And now it's even separated out. So it was a national study group where you had the same protocol for several places. And you signed up patients and did all these things together. And then every now and then you review all your data together.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a very good program. And that's how the leukemics from 100% fatal now has become 10-15% most.
Amazing.
And by the time I left, we had already started being much more aggressive about treating them. And that's how they treat them now. Of course, they have new drugs now, but you know. No, and at that point, I didn't feel I had kept up. It was 5 years in between. And so it's hard to keep up with something that's moving that fast. So I taught general pediatrics. At first it was just well baby clinics, and I just went from there.
Mm-hmm.
No, I'm just a pediatrician.
I think you have a great background. So now you were
part-time.
Coming back full-time.
Well, that was in 19, must have been, well, before that I was involved in several places before I did the full-time. I was involved with the nursing school with a nurse practitioner, pediatric nurse practitioner program, where I was giving a few lectures. And then the next year, the person who ran the program left, and all of a sudden they said, oh, you're running this whole course. Not having ever taught a course, it was a lot of work. And then I got to go to Weissman Center to be head of the developmental clinic. And again, I said to Bill Seeger, I don't know much about development. And he says, that's all right, you'll do fine there. Anyway.
No, it was the Weissman Center, it was the new building up by
yes.
that time?
Yes, yeah. So this was in 83 to 84, to 89, and he graduated in 84. So that was when I went full time. I had three jobs, so I figured I better go full time.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. The nursing school job was 30%, the pediatric job was 60%, and the Weissman Center was 30-40% since I was directing the clinic.
Now they're talking about making these nurse practitioners doctors.
Well, you know, I taught them everything that they needed to know about sick patients, how to examine them, what to look for, when to call a doctor, or when to treat themselves. And this is what the nurse practitioners are able to do. And now I see they even can write prescriptions. And when I taught them, I always said, don't forget that you are nurses, because you give a lot more personal, sympathetic, empathetic care than the doctors do. You're there for the patient. The doctor is there for the disease. That's most of the time. So that don't forget that part. You know. So I think most of them do well.
They're wonderful.
I'm being taken care of one by one at the pain clinic, and she's just very good. You know. I mean, she sees me as a person, rather than, oh, you give this drug, this is the dose you give. You know, she sees me as, can you tolerate that much? You know, is it enough? And that kind of stuff for you, not for the general public.
Mm-hmm.
So it's really nice. You know. So anyway, I really enjoy teaching them. They were all graduate students, of course. So they were all eager, you know. Most of the time they paid attention. And then next you can see several times whoever ran the clinic left.
Making you the acting director, right?
Twice. it didn't show my first... Oh, yeah, the first time. Yeah, the first time was actually Mark Hansen. He left to go to the family physician.
Family practice.
Family practice, yeah.
He started that, did he not?
Right. Well, the pediatric part,
mm-hmm.
he was part of it. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And the second time, the person who was director... who was not doing a very good job, got mad and just quit that day.
Why?
Yes, and so we all looked at each other, we called Bill Seeger in, and he said, well, you're going to do it.
Me?
Yes. And I think I did it for a couple of years. Yeah, that's right. he offered me the job, but I never felt that... that I could help the people in my group to become research people. I didn't have that training behind me. So I felt that I didn't have the knowledge to help them get started and so on. There are people in the department who did, in my section who did, but it wasn't enough, I thought. And the person that came replace me was somebody who had a lot of research knowledge, but not much clinical knowledge. So that it ended up that he was the director, and I was doing a lot of clinical part. And after a while, I finally decided to retire. You know, it was just getting too much. Plus, Ray was a little distressed when I get up at 2 a.m. to drive to the hospital. I took care of the interns in the ER. We were all supposed to take care of them. But if we had a student doing an externship, most of the faculty refused to be on call with them. So Schoenweiler and I did most of it for the students. And it's the most teaching time.
Sure.
You know, it's a great teaching place. So anyway.
Now these Weissman children are all retarded and...
they're disabled, not all retarded. In fact, one of them, and I can mention his name because he finally did pass away, was Jeff Erlander, who got onto Madison Board of Directors or something. He was quadriplegic, but he learned to, he could talk. Or did he learn to talk through a machine? No, I think he could talk. And he couldn't write too well, but they gave him, you know, all kinds of instrument. He was so bright. Supposedly he had a tumor in his spinal cord. When he was in California, they operated, and after that, he became a quadriplegic.
Oh, dear.
But he was a very bright little boy, and he did well. And he did very well. So, no, not all of them. A lot of them came because, because they had behavioral problem, physical problem, and also mental problems.
Mm-hmm.
So we did have different... the reason I was the director, where I didn't need to know anything, was because I needed to pull these people together. that was the main, my main job, pulling them together, trying to get them, you know, to agree, getting the reports out in time and that kind of stuff. So that was my job, which I didn't feel I did too well either. You know, it really wasn't my calling.
It's a very tough job.
Yeah, it is. They were very good people to work with. But, the other reason was that I looked at all the insurance companies, and they weren't paid. You know, they just didn't cover that kind of stuff. So our clinic was so much in the red, they had closed.
Oh, that's awful.
Yeah. So now all they have is a research teaching clinic where they see one patient a week or something like that for teaching students. It's the CP clinic is over there now. So, the specialties clinic can function to a certain degree. Medic Aid, which is supposed to help them, the government runs out in Medic Aid by September. Nobody gets paid. You'll get paid next January again. You know, it was really eye opening trying to get all these looking at all these insurances.
Yes, I can imagine.
It was kind of a disaster. So most of Weissman now is more research than research and teaching, rather than as I said, the CP clinic. I don't know if the spina bifida clinic might be there too. And those are very specialized.
Now, they have a little school, don't they?
Yes, they have a school where they have, I think it's half, quote, normal children and half disabled.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's a preschool.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And again, it's a teaching place. They have students.
Yes.
So.
That's a good idea.
Yeah.
We're looking at the committees that you've served on.
Right.
And the admissions committee was of particular interest?
To me, yes.
Do you?
Well, the reason I say that is because I think I had the most to contribute. Each of us would take a student's folder, review it, and try to explain why we thought the students should or should not be admitted. And the two other people also reviewed it, but you're the presenter, and they could disagree or agree with you. So we presented to the whole group, and then we voted. So basically, you had the responsibility for that student. And mostly, you were responsible for saying, I would like to have this student for this and this, and the other two people would, you know, find problems or whatever. And the whole group would also ask questions. So it took us quite a while. And it took, I guess they would say 5 or 6 hours on a Sunday preparing for this.
Now, this is admission to the medical school,
yes,
or to the residency?
To the medical school. I was really not involved with admissions to the residency, but I was very involved with the residents. We started a program where each resident came every week and followed their patient with the same staff person. So they got a lot more general pediatrics in a continuity clinic. That's what I called it, continuity clinics. And each of us had three residents, one, you know, senior, there's various years that they are here. And you got to know the resident pretty well, and the resident got to know you too, and how you function, how you teach, and so on. And I really enjoyed that teaching. It was a one-on-one. Some of the residents were just so good, you know, I sort of felt, what am I going to teach you, you know? But there are a lot of little things you can help them with, which they don't learn from books. And I think that's what we were there for. How to handle a patient, you know. How do you look at a two-year-old's ears who refuses to be looked at? You know, a lot of details are how you practice pediatrics.
Mm-hmm.
And I enjoyed that very much. And a lot of the residents I advised unofficially, but especially a lot of women came to me to ask questions, tell me problems and that kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So it was interesting. I really did enjoy my job once I was out of the instructor's stage. And I have to tell you, I got 20 foot 5% raise twice.
That was wonderful.
The last one was when I was full professor, and Phil Farrell was chair, and he looked at it, at the how much we were each earning, and there were two that was way below from everybody else. And I think he was a little worried that we were going to sue the department because both of us were women.
Oh, my goodness.
Mm-hmm. So that's when I got another tremendous raise. We got to the lowest level of the men, at least. So I can't complain about it.
You have to be aware all the time when you're
a woman, in
this sort of a situation.
I was not trained that way. You know, I had never met bias before I came to Wisconsin. In New York, it was very, you know, well, the medical schools were, you know. When I got accepted by Penn, I didn't really want to go to Penn. It was the same as Bryn Mawr. I called the other medical school and asked, you know, what are my chances? And Cornell said, well, we'll look at this. Oh, yeah, you're a woman. Well, we won't decide on you till next February. And the only one of my classmates who got in, Cornell, both her parents are lawyers for Cornell.
Oh, my. That's called bias.
I just didn't have that pull. So I was not used to any bias.
Now, you were on the physician panel for the quality of care evaluation. That would have been interesting.
Yes and no. I was on it very shortly, I think.
86, 87.
Yeah, for a year, and I'm not sure I did very much for them.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we had students, and I think we, Center for Policy, my goodness, I don't know what I was doing there. I did more in the clinical education part.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, I had students, and they would see they were first or second year students who would go take a history, and then we'd sort of take it apart, you know, or go in there and help them take a history.
Have you mentored a class?
No, they've asked me to, and I really didn't.
That's a big job.
It's a big job. Yeah, very. And also, I felt that again, I didn't have the research aspect to be able to counsel them.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think they need both sides when they're students.
Mm-hmm.
So I didn't feel I was called for it.
Mm-hmm. Well, now you've retired.
Mm-hmm.
And how is that going?
Fine. I volunteered, of course. I mean, everybody's calling you to volunteer.
Right.
So I volunteered first for the Red Cross. I got on the board first, and then I saw that there was places I could volunteer, so besides serving coffee, taking blood pressures,
mm-hmm.
I became the chair of the volunteer services group. And that was kind of a disaster because one person left who was very good. The chief of that service left. And so we were without anybody for a while. And so I helped two young girls there with what they had to do. And then somebody came on who was turned out to be a disaster. And when she left, you know, we had more work to do, the three of us. And then came the memo from up above that everybody had to be trained to do their jobs, which is fine. The volunteers have to be trained for their jobs. And if you miss a few days, then you have to be retrained every 3 months. And we're talking about volunteers who've done that single job for 10 years. And I'm going to go up to her and say, you have to be trained, or you're out of here. A lot of them just out of here by themselves. And it was very hard to try to convince them, you know, that, well, this is, you know, quality of care and all that business, which I thought was baloney, but it turned out that as a physician, I couldn't take blood pressures unless I went to a class to teach me how to take blood pressures. The only thing I could do was serve coffee.
Oh, my goodness.
So I decided, you know, there are other things I can do.
What a waste.
Yeah. And, you know, the physicians who were helping with blood pressures and that kind of stuff just quit. Actually, most of the nurses are no quit too, because they were told that they didn't need nurses anymore, they just needed technicians.
To draw blood?
To draw blood. The fact is that the history is very important. The private history part
right.
is where you pick up problems.
Sure.
And your instinct tells you, you know, there's a problem we need to address. And these nurses were very good at that. And they would tell patients, I'm sorry, but you cannot donate today, or things like that, you know. And they would go through all the drugs and say, oh, you know, this drug is, I think you get into trouble. It was not one of the forbidden ones, but it was one that might get into trouble. You know, so I think the nurses were good. Finally, they did keep, you know, rehire some, but I think they're LPNs, not RNs.
Oh, my.
So a lot of them quit. I see some of them still, and, you know, we talk about the good old days.
Mm-hmm. That's too bad.
Yeah, it really is. I mean, they do a great service, but, you know, the department that works the best is the one that goes out to the fires and, you know, that big pileup and that kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And those volunteers are dedicated. It's just amazing how they'll pick up and go wherever
mm-hmm.
they need it, you know. A lot of them are retired people. Just go, do their job.
That's wonderful.
Yeah. So I quit that, and then I was on the board of Literacy Council, where all we could talk about was how to get more money, and I'm just not a money person. And so I stayed with them for 1 year and then resigned. And then there was a little article in the newspaper said, volunteer needed to work with Braille. I thought, to learn Braille. So I thought, how hard can that be? So I went in there and they said, oh, would you like to sign up for this class? And I said, oh, sure. There were 11 of us to start with, 3 of us finished the class.
That's hard.
And I was the only one who got certified at the end. The other two quit for different reasons. You know, they probably could have, but it was hard. It's a national Congress of Library of Congress that has to certify us. And they're very strict. You miss a comma, that's 2 points off. And you can only miss 10 points, and then that's it. It was the hardest thing I've ever done.
Are you typing, translating?
Transcribing.
Transcribing.
Yeah. On the computer.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And it's still hard.
Oh, that's marvelous to do that.
So.
I'm going to turn the tape over, and then we're going to talk about
okay.
some of the things that Dr. Chun has done. Side one with Dr. Mei-Mei Chun. And we're going to talk about some of the teaching responsibilities and the talks that she gave in the community.
I got interested in accidents because when I was in oncology, I felt bad for the patients, but I realized that nobody was responsible for it. You know, the parents didn't do anything wrong, the kids didn't do anything wrong. Most of the time the environment was okay. But when a patient comes in because of trauma, you know, there is somebody who goofed somewhere. And so I thought that if we can prevent accidents, then we've given a lot of help. And so we started writing little pamphlets to give to the parents for each age group. You know, these are the things to look for. And maybe it doesn't, you think it might not help, but if the parents can change things in the house to help the child, it might make a difference. There was a study in Harlem, actually New York, where kids kept falling out of windows because the windows were not barred or anything. So they started building where the builders had to put bars on the windows. They found that there were much less accidents. Your kids were not trying to climb up. They just fell out because there was nothing to stop them. And if they had something to stop them, it would help. So you change the environment, you might be able to prevent an accident. And so we wrote up all these pamphlets. And I would give talks to various people, classes actually, students. I didn't write down all the schools I went to give talks. So it should be age appropriate. And from there, I thought, well, I was working with two other people. Somehow the residents don't know what to tell the parents, how to feed the child, how to take care of them, how to prevent accidents and so on. So we started doing what we call the problem-oriented chart, which included a series of pieces of paper for each age group. On it we had the history, what history should the residents be taking, and we would write some of it so that they would have to ask those questions, And then we had the physical exam, and we expected them to do the whole thing, and if they didn't, they crossed it off. And then we gave them things to look for development, and then the counseling part. So each sheet of paper for each age group had what the whole visit should be about. And I presented that to the problem, hospital problem, chart problem, or whatever you call it, chart. We wanted the hospital to bless the program. And the first question came up, how do you know the resident won't cheat and mark everything up? And I said, they can cheat now. Without the piece of paper, they can still cheat and say everything's okay. The reason I can say that is because we reviewed 100 charts. And a lot of them, we couldn't tell if it was a boy or girl. No mention. Genitalia, not mentioned. All it said was within normal limits. The whole physical exam within normal limits. That was the sentence they would write. I said, how do you know what they examined or didn't examine? Anyway, they turned down those sheets, but Kathy DeAngelis, who was with me on that, published it in her book. And now all the nurses from all the clinics here, Well Baby Clinics, all use that. I've had people from northern Wisconsin ask me, it's copyrighted, and I said, do whatever you want, it's okay with me, because it changes every year, right? The immunizations change, the thought about what, we can do and cannot do changes. So I know it's been used many places. And people, as a whole, don't cheat. It's just that it's too much trouble to write all the physical exam. You don't have that kind of time. So if you can just check off the ones you did, you're much more likely to do it.
Do you think tape recorders and computers are going to be helpful in this?
Well, the computers are in, and the only complaint I hear from everybody is that, in first place, this generation didn't learn how to type. My grandson at 4 can type. That's because it's a toy that they have already. We didn't have that. So it takes them longer, to use the computer. They have to enter everything into the computer, which as a patient is great. But for the doctor, it takes twice the time. And what do you do when the computer's down?
Yes.
I went to see Norm Jensen the other day, and we sat there and waited for the computer to come back up.
And he told me that he's been working with a computer for years and years,
so he was
ready for it.
He was ready, but not when it goes down.
When it goes down.
So there are glitches everywhere. And I don't know, I think the computer does ask you a lot of questions. I was a guinea pig on the first one, and it took me an hour to fill out the history. Because it was a yes-no all the time. And there was a tremendous long history, and you sat there for a whole hour and filled that in. That was in probably in the 60s, somebody started with it. Now it's, of course, much more easy to use compared to then. but they have not asked patients to do it yet.
Well, you get, in the mail, you get a paper report that you have to,
yes,
you know,
every time.
Six pages or something that you have to fill in.
But that's different from the computer, and I suspect because half the patients would really not be able to do the computer. But it would be nice. As a patient, I would love to have it on a computer and they email it to me or whatever, and then I just fill it in. You know, with, plus, they would have what I answered last time, which would help me a lot. Did you have your appendix up? Well,
oh, heavens, who knows?
Yeah.
They have a little underneath the question that says, if it has not changed since the last time you did this.
Yeah. Yes. Actually, the clinic stopped using it when I left. And now they're back using it. That says something, you know. And because it's copyrighted, I told them you can do whatever you need to do.
Well, with this huge new hospital, they must have a huge new number of patients.
Maybe. I don't know.
Dr. Chun applied to go to Cornell for medical school, and what happened?
When I was accepted somewhere else, I wrote to all the places, I called them to ask, you know, what are my chances there? And quite a few places were very nice and say, well, we'll look at your record. We haven't decided yet. And Cornell looked at it and says, oh, you're a woman. They couldn't tell from my name. You know, Mamie doesn't mean anything to them. Oh, we don't look at your application till February. And this was October. So I didn't go there.
They waited to see how many men they could get first.
Well, Columbia accepted 10%. That was their quota, 10% women. They had quotas for everything. 25% was from New York, you know, City College, well, Columbia itself. And then some were from Princeton, but they, you know, it was a fair way to do it. People don't think it is fair, but in those days, that was the way it was done. And so
Is there such a quota system here? I hear there are many, many women medical students.
No, there wasn't a quota when I was on the committee. And we really try to look at them, not just at their MCATs and all that kind of stuff, but really what else they've done, which I think is the most important, you know, because you can be thing to all this is that I'm Chinese, let's make that clear. But it turns out that the Chinese students and some of the other Asian students who are here going to medical school will get straight A's the first 2 years. And all of a sudden in third year and fourth year, they can't handle it because people have always, they have been pushed to study and to have good exams and to know their books. But the interpersonal part has been missing. And so they're afraid to ask the patients too many questions. They don't know how to handle it. They don't know how to handle a professor who asks them questions. It shakes them, and so they don't do as well, even though they know the book stuff. But they can't bring it out. You give them differential diagnosis. Well, you know, wait a minute. The book says this, and the book says that. How do I put it together? You know, so a friend of mine has started a counseling program for the Asian students. And what they do is try to teach them how to handle people, how to respond to people, how to talk to patients, how to talk to your professor. And it's a good program. We had one here last year, but the students have to run it. And us, the professors, especially the Asian ones, and others, will help them. And we'll talk to the student who's having problems and try to problem solve with them. I'm talking about students who are brought up here. They're not from Asia because of how they're taught at home, which is you should know the whole book. You should be able to memorize the book, be able to bring it back out. But you're not really taught the practical part.
Hmm.
Anyway, that's some.
That's very interesting.
I've been involved with that tangentially. We decided we were too old to see first year medical students.
They probably would love it.
I wasn't going to talk that much. I was just going to answer your questions.
Well, thank you very much, Dr. Chun. We appreciate your taking the time to do this, and it's been a great pleasure. Thank you.